So our reading is from Romans chapter 13. It's on page 200 in the New Testament section of the Pew Bible, if anybody is following from the Bible there. Duties towards the state authorities and duties towards one another. Everyone must obey the state authorities because no authority exists without God's permission. And the existing authorities have been put there by God. Whoever opposes the existing authority opposes what God has ordered, and everyone who does so will bring judgment on himself. For rulers are not to be feared by those who do good, but by those who do evil. Would you like to be unafraid of those in authority? Then do what is good, and they will praise you, because they are God's servants working for your own good. But if you do evil, then be afraid of them, because their power is to punish Israel. They're God's servants and carry out God's punishment on those who do evil. For this reason, you must obey the authorities, not just because of God's punishment, but also as a matter of conscience. That is also why you pay taxes, because the authorities are working for God when they fulfill their duties. Pay then what you owe them. Pay them your personal and property tax, and show respect and honour for them all. Be under obligation to no one. The only obligation you have is to love one another. Whoever does this has obeyed the law. The commandments: do not commit adultery, do not commit murder, do not steal, do not desire what belongs to someone else. All these and any others beside are summed up in one command: love your neighbor as you love yourself. If you love someone, you will never do them wrong. If you love someone, you will never do them wrong. To love, then, is to obey the whole law. You must do this because you know that the time has come for you to wake up from your sleep. For the moment when we will be saved is closer now than it was when we first believed. The night is nearly over. The day is almost here. Let us stop doing the things that belong to the dark, and let us take up weapons for fighting in the light. Let us conduct ourselves properly as people who live in the light of day. No orgies or drunkenness, no immorality or indecency, no fighting or jealousy, but take up the weapons of the Lord Jesus Christ, and stop paying attention to your sinful nature and satisfying its desires.
As I indicated earlier, Paul tends to change the subject once he gets to the last part of Romans. And in chapter 12, he addresses relationships with God, with ourselves, with one another, and even with those whom we call our enemies. In Romans 13, he moves on to address either two or three relationships, basic issues. In relationship to the state, as it says in the Good News Bible, and also our duties towards one another. But there's also that reference to the end times, as to how we're supposed to live when we're living in the end times. And it begins in verses 1 to 7, with the most controversial thing, I think, when we're talking about the Christian's relationship to the state. And if you look at it carefully, in verses 1 and 2, he states no less than three times that everyone must obey the state authority. It's not a command that sits all that comfortably with most people, particularly if we don't approve of what the state is currently doing. If we don't approve of the cycle lanes down green lanes, we might be inclined to take a pneumatic drill and dig them up, but we're not free to do so. And over the years, there have been four main models of the relationship between state and the church. The state has controlled the church has controlled the state has favored the church, and the church has accommodated the state. And finally, there's been constructive collaboration in which each recognizes and encourages the other's distinct God-given responsibilities. None of those perfectly matches what we have today. We certainly don't live in a Christian state. But perhaps that last model, where there is a role for the state and a role for the church, and each tries to encourage each other, is the closest that we might have of those four. It's also the model that Paul is probably assuming. And although, of course, the Romans were an occupying power, the Jewish nation had a great deal of privilege within that power. They still had the temple. They still, amongst themselves, could apply their own laws to some extent. And then Paul goes on to give the reasons why the state authority should be obeyed. And he says it's because they cannot exist without God's permission, that they have been put there by God. And that is actually consistent with what the Old Testament says, if we look at it. It's a whole theme that says that God is actually controlling the events of history. But of course, he's doing it in ways that we cannot really understand. No one would want to pretend that what we have is an ideal government in charge of us. But there's also the issue of free will. And we may not fully understand what God is doing and why he's doing it, but we need to hold on to the fact that he is. And this is the premise on which Paul is speaking to us. He is saying, this is what God is doing. This is how he's ordered it. And therefore, you must obey the state authorities. And people in the Old Testament weren't too happy about it. Habakkuk wasn't very happy when God told him that he was raising up the Babylonians to punish the Jewish nation because all of that, what they were doing. But in the end, if you read through that book, it's a very interesting one. Habakkuk comes to the point where he accepts that, where he sees that there are good reasons for God doing it, and where he sees that in the end, the evil of the Babylonians will not prosper. But it's not just the Old Testament that says that either. Jesus famously made that statement when he's presented with a coin and asked about taxes. He says, "Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." And that surely implies that God had appointed Caesar. And there are further references, if you wish to look them up at a later time, in Timothy chapter 2, in Titus chapter 3, in 1 Peter chapter 2, which address the same issue of obedience to the state, and also go further to say, talk about praying for those who govern us. Later on in church history, there are two people whose names you may have heard who said things about the state. Justin Martyr said, when addressing the state, "We worship only God, but in other things we will gladly serve you." Tertullian said, "Caesar is more ours than yours because God has appointed him." And Paul emphasizes the point about obedience in verse 2 when he says that if we oppose the existing authority, what we are really doing is opposing God. And he says further, we will bring judgment on ourselves. It's not something that we are permitted to do. Now, if we look back at the New Testament, we see that in many ways Paul had benefited from the protection of the Roman authorities against his enemies. They had prevented riots, prevented him being killed. But at the same time, he'd also suffered under it as well. Paul had no illusions about the imperfections of human government, and yet he is still urging obedience, or as most translations have it, submission to the authorities. So if Paul can say this about the occupying power of Rome, then surely the same applies to us when we live in a democratically elected society. Certainly we have to recognize the limits of obedience to the state. We have to be permitted to try and affect change. Obedience to God certainly comes, though, before obedience to the state. That's the position taken by Christians from Roman times to the current day, by God-fearing people in Old Testament times. Daniel's three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, refused to bow down to the golden statue set up by Nebuchadnezzar, because that would have been against God's law. Peter and the apostles told the Sanhedrin, the Jewish council, that they needed to obey God rather than them when there was a conflict. In fact, the URC statement of faith affirms that loyalty to God overrides loyalty to the state. And perhaps the situation can be best summed up in this way. The gospel is equally hostile to tyranny and anarchy. So when what the state decrees is not in direct opposition to God's commands, we are to obey. Doesn't mean we can't campaign for change, but we are to obey. On the other hand, whenever laws are enacted which contradict God's law, disobedience becomes not just possible, but mandatory. It becomes a Christian duty. And then Paul goes on to address, to a certain extent, the role of the state. He goes on to say that those who do good are not to be in fear of the state, only those who do evil. And he is telling us that the state is working for our good and praising us when we do good. And that's clearly the ideal. It doesn't always happen perfectly. Yet in many respects, it was true of the Roman rulers, and it was within God's plan. Just look at how the Roman peace allowed travel across roads, allowed the widespread spread of Christianity throughout the known world of Paul's time. We may have, indeed I'm sure we all have, many reasons to be critical of our current government, but it does work for us in many ways. By and large, it maintains order, provides transport, education, healthcare. More mundanely, it keeps the lights on, maintains the sewers. And generally, state authorities preserve the world from chaos. We can see that just from the Middle East, where the state has collapsed, even if it's an evil state, what sort of chaos has ensued. But then Paul looks at the other side of it and says that the state is God's servant and also carries out God's punishment on those who do evil. Personal revenge is forbidden to us, but the state can carry out God's punishment. And in most translations, verse 4 actually makes a reference to the sword. The New International Version translates, "For he does not bear the sword for nothing." And that's quite a challenging statement. And commentators are in two groups. Some think it's a reference simply to military power, maintaining an army, I suppose. But probably the majority say that the context makes it more likely to be a reference to capital punishment. And it's clearly a symbol of death earlier in the letter. And no less a commentator than John Stott says that if that is so, capital punishment is a permissible penalty. He points out that it's not mandatory. We only have to go back to the beginning of the Bible with Cain and Abel to see that. And there's always a concern about punishing the innocents. But sometimes, if there aren't mitigating circumstances, it suggests that perhaps we should recognize that the crime of taking a human life is so serious that capital punishment might be appropriate. Interestingly, more recently, we've had a real problem with terror attacks, haven't we? We've seen people go around with suicide vests, and I wonder what we would prefer to be done when that happens. It's just a thought. But Paul urges obedience to the state not just because of punishment for disobedience, whatever that punishment might be and whatever we might think appropriate. But he urges obedience because it's God's will. And then arguably, and perhaps even more controversially than the issue of capital punishment, Paul goes on to the issue of paying taxes. And his justification is exactly the same. The authorities for working for God and they must have the resources to do so. And he goes on to speak of respect and honour for those involved. So I have to tell you this morning that if you have any enmity towards the tax and revenue inspectors, then you need to think again. What you might ask if I think that a particular tax is unfair? Well, to be honest, it's not relevant whether you think it's fair or not. When Jesus was given that coin, he didn't discuss the fairness of Roman taxes. He simply said, pay them. And we in our position have even less reason to withhold our taxes, either openly or by stealth, since we do actually have a say in who governs us. In any case, I suspect that if we had a conversation after church here, even the few of us here would not be in entire agreement about how our tax system should be organised. And we probably need to recognise that we all have a tendency towards self-interest. It's almost unavoidable. I remember once having going to a house group at a church that I used to attend, and for some conversation led to taxes, and somebody there said, you know, he didn't see why there should be any different rates of tax. You know, we have different rates. Some people pay 20%. Most people pay 20%. If you're better off, you pay 40%. If you're really well off, you pay 45% at the moment, but it's changed throughout the years. And this chap said he didn't see any reason why there should be a different percentage across there. And I had to disagree with him because I thought, well, actually, who agrees that the salaries of everybody in our society relative to one another are fair? Is there anyone here? Ask you. If you really believe that, put your hand up and tell me. Do you believe they're fair? No, I didn't think so. And as it happens, this chap did earn quite a lot of money. So if taxes were realigned. So we have to be careful of what we think. We're always prone to look in our own interests. If we're a cyclist, we're prone to say, it's great, we've got all these cycle lanes down green lanes. If we're not, and we're using a bus, or we're stuck behind a bus in a car, then we're likely to have a different view. We need to be kind of open and honest about these things. But we need to recognise we need to have some government or control in place. There's another point that arises for us today, because we do elect our governments. The Romans were not elected. Ours are. And that must place some responsibility on us. Not just to vote, although certainly to vote, but actually to really, even if we're absolutely bored by politics, to at least look at some of the issues, to understand the issues, to understand what we're voting for. We should be in a position to make a rational decision. And then finally, in regard to the state, Paul Timothy says in chapter 2 of his first letter, I urge that petitions, prayers, requests, and thanksgiving be offered to God for all people, for kings and for all others who are in authority, that we may live a quiet and peaceful life with all reverence towards God and with proper conduct. And those in positions of authority need our prayers for a number of reasons, but perhaps two really stand out. Firstly, there are often genuinely difficult decisions. There is pressure being brought to bear from different directions on our politicians locally and nationally. And secondly, there is always going to be temptation, just as there is for us in our personal life, to seek our own good rather than act in the interests of others. And undoubtedly, some have fallen prey to the temptations of money, of ambition, and so on. But that's no reason to have a general disrespect for authority. And it's all the more reason to pray for those in positions of authority. Much more briefly, we come to the last half of the letter. And in verses 10 to 12 in particular, Paul moves on to consider our relationship with the law of God. And here, things I think are a lot more simple in many ways. There is only one obligation, Paul says, and that's to love one another. Because if you do that, all these other things fall into place. You cannot commit adultery, you cannot steal, you cannot murder if you love someone. And Paul quotes Jesus in saying, love your neighbour as you'll love yourself. And even if at times we might dislike ourselves to a considerable extent, we all love ourselves simply because by virtue of looking after ourselves. And that link with the previous section is that the only debt or obligation that we must allow is our obligation to love one another. We must pay our taxes, and when we've done so, that debt is discharged. But our debt of loving one another is never discharged. It's one that is there to be paid every day, and it's still there the following day. And then in the final section from verses 11 to 14, Paul is referring to the second coming of Jesus, when a new order will be put in place, when night, as he puts it, will turn into day. Paul may well have believed that this was to occur fairly soon in his time. Commentators aren't universally in agreement on that point. Regardless, I think that we must consider that what he was doing was urging people to behave as though that time had already come, so that we will be prepared when it really does come. It's almost like not knowing when an exam will take place. If you didn't know that, you'd be revising all the time, making sure that you knew all the answers. He's trying to stir us into action in making progress in living our lives more fully in the way that Jesus wants us to. And he lists six things in verse 13 that are undesirable. Strife or fighting and jealousy are perhaps the most likely to be troublesome for us. Disagreements which escalate and see strife or violence, certainly jealousy can arise all too easily. Taking up the weapons of Jesus Christ could refer to Christian virtues, the armour of God, which Paul refers to in Ephesians chapter 6. The idea is certainly a defensive one, so that we can remain free of the undesirable things that Paul has just listed. In brief, we are being urged to understand that we do actually live in the end times, in the sense that God's work was completed with Jesus. We're now just in the mopping up times. We don't know exactly when the end will come. Our behaviour and our approach to life therefore need to be appropriate to living in such times. They need to be preparing us for the time when night turns into day, when Jesus returns. And so in summary, I think this chapter has laid down how we should relate to the state and to each other and why. We should be obedient to the state as long as that does not mean disobeying God. We should continually show the same love and concern for each other as we do for ourselves. And we should do both of these things because the day is fast approaching when we will be living under a new order in the kingdom of God.